Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamin Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Surya Doita Gadad Har Shivasadi Gaur Bhakti Hare Krishna 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 Krishna, Krishna Hare 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 Ram, Rama Ram, Hare Hare. How you doing? We're all right then. Usually when if it's a smaller group, I would go around the room and ask each of you to tell me your name, personal history, but I think by the time we're done, we'd be finished with our class here this evening. My name is Yogeshwara Das. My students call me Professor Green. My wife calls me, hey, you. I was initiated by Srila Prabhupada in January of 1970 in London. And one of my earliest friends back there was a wonderful young man named Kula Shekhar, who passed away recently. So in honor of my dear friend Bhakti Tirtha Swami and my dear friend Kula Shekhar, thank you very much for inviting me to speak here this evening. I would just ask someone to keep an eye on the clock because it's up there and I can't see. Oh, there's one over there too, right? Okay. So I'm supposed to be done by 6, is that right? And we want to leave lots of room for questions and answers. Or maybe questions and I don't knows, but we'll try. What can I tell you about myself? I'm 62 years old. Married, live on Long Island. I do all that stuff that Mukhya said. And I teach in yoga studios. There's a yoga culture in America that's really only about 40 years old. And a lot of people who have been taking the physical yoga classes, the asana classes, have gotten this idea that there's something more, What's that Om thing you chant at the beginning? What's that Hare Krishna mantra you chant? And there's an appreciation that you don't really understand yoga unless you understand the roots of yoga, the philosophical background. So people with some sense of the devotional heart of yoga, bhakti is the heart, the goal of all yoga practice, yoginamapi sarvesham madgatenantaratmana, 6th chapter, verse 47, Krishna describes that of all yogis, my bhakta, one who has offered himself or herself to me with love, is most dear to me, the highest of all yogis. And also there's some evidence, if you go into the yoga texts, the Dattatreya, Yoga Sutras, the Yoga Vashishta, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, if you go into all of the various yoga texts, you'll see that there are Vaishnava connections there, with Vaishnava roots in yoga. So that's what I do, is I do a lot of teaching. And right now, I'm very honored to be researching a biography of Srila Prabhupada that I've been asked to write. And that's been a very moving experience. It's almost like rediscovering my relationship with my spiritual master, going back into I don't know how many of you have tried to tackle this 35-volume set of conversation transcriptions with Prabhupada, but it's an extraordinary thing. It's like being there in the room with him. And so I'm kind of a little charged right now with the Prabhupada mood. So if I start yelling at you, get out there, you'll understand why. I've been reading all these books. Mukhya asked me to keep it general. I guess the idea being that there are some people who are here for the first time. And so here's the general part, then we'll get specific. The general part is that Krishna consciousness is the original constitutional nature of all living beings. Anything that we say lives, anything that's alive, whether it's a person or a flower or a tree or a bird, anything that's alive that shows the symptoms of life, is alive because there is the presence of a divine spark of God. Life comes from life. It doesn't come from material chemicals. That was an important part of Prabhupada's teachings, to understand the nature of who we are. That's lesson 101 of spiritual life. Is who are we? Who am I? That's the beginning of everything. So that spark is of the same quality as Krishna, the source of all life. The name Krishna means all attractive, the most beautiful. So in the Krishna tradition, the bhakti or devotional tradition, we accept that all life, all of you here in this room, are by nature of the same quality as God, meaning that you are beautiful, you are immortal, you are complete, you are by nature a happy, blissful being, and you're also a person eternally, Satchit Ananda Vigraha, with form, you're endowed with form. So a big part of my life for quite a while now has been migrating that philosophy. That's pretty much it, by the way. That's the whole thing. We have forgotten that original nature by chanting the names of God, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That original awareness of ourselves as eternal divine sparks of God can be revived. We've been in this world for such a long time that we simply forgot. We've forgotten who we are. How many of you drove here this afternoon? All right, well, you know, if you just left your car out there on the lot, you wouldn't have to do anything. You just leave it there. You come back in a couple of weeks. It'd be filthy. It'd be covered with dirt and mud and all kinds. Because the nature of being in this world is that things get dirty, get covered. You don't have to do anything. Just by being here, we become covered. Consciousness becomes covered. So we forget. The longer we're here, the more we forget our original spiritual nature. So that's pretty much, in a nutshell, the whole philosophy of Krishna consciousness. How to explain that in a language that people in 2013 can understand and appreciate is a big part of the challenge for all of us who are representing Krishna consciousness in our respective fields, whatever it may be. So that's what kind of gets me up in the morning, is finding the correspondences between this millennial philosophy and the world that people live in today. So when we say that all living beings are Satchidananda Vigraha, what would be another way of saying that so that people don't scratch their heads and wonder what the heck you're talking about? It might be to say, for example, that the bhakti philosophy says that you are not the result, you are not the accumulation of all of your life's traumas. There is more to you than the bruised psychic self of this one lifetime. Well, we're maybe getting a little bit closer to language that people can appreciate, because everyone's been through some hard times. This is, after all, the material world. And people are encouraged to know that, so I'm not really unworthy. I'm not unlovable. I'm not incapable of doing things. You know, we're saddled with those kinds of self-images from growing up, often with parents who themselves were very spiritually confused. They didn't quite know how, maybe good people, but they didn't know how to raise us spiritually. So finding that language, and I thought what I would do is just go through some language with you. This is a Bhagavad Gita vocabulary sheet that I put together for my students. And I thought what I would do is, because the philosophy gets profound, but there seems to be a tendency to kind of migrate things into a cliche. You know, people have cliches in their heads. I'll never forget in one class at Hofstra University where I teach, We were teaching Shakespeare and teaching Hamlet, and one young man, lovely guy, his hand goes up and he says, "Oh, I so understand Hamlet, you know? I mean, like, his life is so much like my life. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do after I graduate either." Yeah. You can't make this stuff up. So, I mean, it's a lot deeper than it seems. We kind of are acclimated to digestible ways of understanding things. You know, the word karma, for example, like, it's so much deeper than what people understand. So I thought I'd just go down this list. Is this okay? Do some vocabulary? Okay, let's start with karma. I mean, we're already there. You know, the cliched way of describing karma would be to say it's action and the consequent reactions. So it's what you do and the reaction to what you do. Right? So that, well, there's truth to that, but it's so much more profound than we understand. In the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes that. He says karma is so complicated that even an intelligent person trying to understand it gets very bewildered. You know the story of the two farmers? You know, the poor, good farmer and the wealthy, envious farmer? You know that story? There's these two farmers living side by side. I don't think it was Alachua County, but they were living side by side. And the poor farmer had one horse, and the rich, envious farmer is looking out his window, and he sees that the poor farmer's one horse has broken out of the barn and run up into the mountains. So he goes over gloating and says, "Ha, guess bad luck, you lost your horse." And the good farmer, who had some philosophical understanding, says, "Well, good luck, bad luck, who knows?" The next day, the poor farmer's horse comes down from the mountains with a partner. His horse has found a mate, and now he's got, you know, the envious farmer comes up and says, "Well, I guess it was good luck, you know. Now you got two horses." And the wise poor farmer says, "Well, good luck, bad luck, who knows?" And the next day, the poor farmer's son breaks a leg trying to tame that wild mare that has come down from the mountains. And the envious farmer comes up, he's gloating, "I guess it was bad luck after all. Your son broke his leg." And, well, bad luck, good luck, who knows? The next day, the country goes to war. All of the young men are sent out to be killed except the poor farmer's son who's got a broken leg. So you get the idea. It kind of goes on and on and on. So when something good happens to you, is that good karma? Or is it perhaps the preface to some very tragic chapter of life? You know how many people, we were just talking about this earlier, how many people have committed suicide after winning the lottery? They can't deal with it. So it seems like good karma, and yet it leads to the most disastrous of consequences. And on the other hand, something very tragic may happen. There's a devotee in New York whose mother is a psychologist teaching at C.W. Post University. And she's written a book called Post-Traumatic Growth, somewhat controversial area of psychology. But essentially what it says is that things happen under adverse circumstances to compel growth and maturity that might not otherwise have occurred. There's something very strange about us human beings. We seem to do quite well under adverse circumstances, which is why you don't really hear a lot of innovative stuff coming out of Hawaii, for example. I mean, if life's that good, where's the impetus to do anything? You know? When there's adversity, we seem to rise, or can rise, to the challenge. So who knows if there's some tragedy in your life. Perhaps that's the doorway into some new, creative, very exciting and powerful new chapter of life. So it's very hard to define that. When we talk about karma in some of my classes at, let's say, Jiva Mukti Yoga School, I'll talk a lot about parenting. I'm very big on parenting. It's like, you know, as far as I've seen, the Bhagavad Gita is a parallel course of study with advanced psychology. Absolutely parallel teachings with regard to how we develop our personalities, how we develop our behavior, our worldview, It's described there in Bhagavad Gita, but again, finding the right vocabulary to migrate one to the other is critically important. So at one time in my peripatetic life, I was seeing a therapist, wonderful woman, Martha Friedman. She used to teach at Columbia. She's gone now. She wrote a book called How to Overcome the Fear of Success. Now, when you hear that, you kind of do a double take. You say, well, wait a minute, that's counterintuitive. That doesn't make sense. People are afraid of failure, not success. We're afraid of success because we grow up with this baggage on us. It's subconscious, and very often the roots are something that are so buried in the subconscious that we don't even remember that they're there, which says, I don't really deserve this. I don't deserve to advance spiritually, for example. So we behave in such a way that actually impedes our spiritual advancement. We'll do something to stop ourselves from getting the very thing that we want. So, for example, let's say that you grow up and your parents are always fighting, right? And so they don't give you any attention. So what might a child do to get attention? If this child is concerned that my parents are fighting and maybe they're heading for divorce, and, you know, what am I? Maybe that child will act up in school, because then the call comes from the principal. You know, you got to come and talk with us. You know, your daughter's, because now the attention is going to the daughter, and they're not going to fight anymore. Right? So maybe that acting up will continue on in later life. Or if you have a parent who's unemotional, uncommunicative, and when you do something good, you never got the feedback you wanted. You know, your father, your mother never was able to say to you, what a wonderful thing you did. That's so fantastic. I'm so proud of you. Maybe you never got that reinforcement. So if succeeding never got the reinforcement that you wanted, what might you do to get parental attention? You'd fail. You'd do something wrong. Because then, why aren't you it might be negative, but at least you're getting some attention. You're getting something, some feedback from your parents. So that may also carry out into later life. So that, you know, there was one, Martha told me about one patient she had who always wanted to finish her college degree and just never seemed to finish that last course. She couldn't get those last three credits. In therapy, it turned out that she had a younger sister, and her parents, when she was growing up, bless their hearts, would always prefer the younger daughter. And they would always be criticizing this young woman who was the older sibling and telling her in front of her face, well, at least one of our kids turned out okay. Yeah. Parents, God bless them. So she could never finish her college degree because she's always thinking, this is going to hurt my sister. If I succeed, it's going to rob something away from my younger sister who deserves it more than I do. So there was a famous composer, Grammy Award-winning composer, who was one of Martha's patients, who Martha invited him to address one of her classes up at Columbia. So he went up there and he said to her students, Martha didn't know I was going to tell you this. Don't believe her. There's no such thing as fear of success. Even my worst song won a Grammy Award. I love what I do. I love success. One of Martha's students, very smart young woman, raised her hand and said, did you always want to be a songwriter? He said, no. You know, earlier in my life, I wanted to be a classical pianist. So this student says, well, now you're a big success. Why don't you go back and start a career as a classical pianist? And he said, well, you know, it's a funny thing. Whenever I tried to do that, I somehow seemed to burn my fingers. That's like saying, somehow I got pregnant. You know, there's a reason for these things. There's a reason. And it's very often that we don't really think that we're worthy of getting what we want. So we act in a way. One of her patients was the actor, what was his name? He starred in Jaws. Yeah, Richard Dreyfuss. Thank you. Richard Dreyfuss was up for an Academy Award, and Martha asked him, how do you feel about being nominated for an Oscar? And he thought for a minute and said, this one's probably worth cancer. Meaning, if I get something good, because I don't really deserve it, what's it going to cost me? I remember a dream I used to have. Because I have a nice house out on Long Island, and you know, I live a very nice life, and I used to have this dream that there was a big moving van that would pull up, and these guys in dark suits and black sunglasses would knock on the door and say, we got your number, we're taking it all back. So we have these, you know, anyway, this started with the idea of karma, right? Now, you could say, well, all of that really just has to do with this one lifetime. I thought karma was, you know, for many lifetimes. Well, that may be. There may be this karmic, cosmic architecture to our life. But you can't access those past lives. There's no hoping for a better past. The life you can deal with is this life. And this is the one that we are obliged to deal with. So understanding how we are, the way we are, is a part of our spiritual discipline. Always being vigilant for understanding why our behavior is the way it is and being cautious. Okay. That's karma. Okay, how about samsara, reincarnation? Is that little clip queued up? Does it work? All right, this is when we talk about reincarnation up at Jiva Mukti, I'll sometimes show this little clip. It only runs about 5 minutes. So if somebody wanted to run that, maybe turn the lights down so you can see a little better. All right.
Now we move on to our series on the paranormal. 3 out of 4 Americans believe in some kind of paranormal activity. But what about reincarnation, being reborn in the body of another? Half of Americans believe, half do not. And if you're one of these skeptics, try to explain how a little boy could know specific details about a fighter pilot who lost his life more than 60 years ago. It's a story you have to see to believe.
Okay, this is really tough. I need somebody to help me.
All right, I'm the volunteer. What do you want me to do?
Okay, I'm just going to climb this thing and you have to hold me in case I fall.
Done.
This is James Leiniger at 6, all boy and all spirit.
This is a special plane. It goes in reverse. You don't see a lot of that.
James knows a lot about planes, especially war planes.
What kind of airplane is that?
It's a Corsair.
His parents, Andrea and Bruce Leiniger, say from an early age, James would play with nothing else.
He was obsessed with airplanes. You look around the house, that's all you'll see. Airplanes, helicopters, aircraft carriers.
But then, when he was 2, the planes James loved suddenly began to give him frequent and frightening nightmares.
I'd wake him up and he'd be screaming and he'd always be laying on his back, kicking his feet up at the ceiling. And I'd say, baby, what were you dreaming about? And he'd say, airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out.
They sound like typical kiddie nightmares, but Andrea says they went on the same way for months. Maybe too much TV. But James was just 2, and his parents say only watching Barney and Teletubbies.
Teletubbies!
And Andrea and Bruce say they weren't watching World War II documentaries or conversing about military history.
This is an F-18?
No, that one.
So what explains the nightmares and James's strange obsession with airplanes?
I talked to my mom about it a lot of times, and my mom has said maybe he's remembering a past life.
What did you say?
Politely, baloney.
But as time went by, Andrea didn't know what to believe. Here's James at age 3, going over a plane as if he's doing a pre-flight check. He would continue to say and do things that were puzzling, like the time his mom bought him a toy airplane.
And I said, oh, look, there's a bomb on the bottom of it. He said, that's not a bomb, Mama, that's a drop tank.
A drop tank?
I'd never heard of a drop tank. I didn't know what a drop tank was.
His parents say between the ages of 2 and 4, James would reveal extraordinary details about the life of a former fighter pilot, James M. Houston, Jr., mostly at bedtime when he was drowsy.
Bruce said, what happened to your plane? He said, it crashed on fire. And Bruce said, why did your airplane crash? And he said, it got shot. And Bruce said, well, who shot your plane? And I'll never forget the look on his face. He went, oh, the Japanese.
So what do you believe now about your son, James?
I believe that he had a past life. I believe that in his past life, he was James M. Houston, Jr. And he came back because he wasn't finished with something. And that's essentially what I believe.
And he's not the only one. This is Anne Barron, the sister of pilot James Houston. She has met the Leiningers and can come up with only one plausible explanation for James's past life memories.
The child was so convincing in coming up with all these things that there's no way in the world he could know unless there is a spiritual thing.
Today, James is 8 years old and finally free from the painful memories of James Houston Jr.'s death. The nightmares have stopped, but his love of airplanes continues to grow.
So, you know, the evidence is actually quite voluminous. Past life experiences, near-death experiences, you know. If you're really interested in this stuff, you could look at the work of Ian Stevenson, who did quite a lot of research into past life experiences. So why do I show that? Well, because it's one thing to talk about scriptural teachings. We live in an age, and even we who are kind of oriented to understanding things in spiritual language, you know, we talk about the soul and consciousness and so on, we actually like to get the scientific data to back things up. We feel better, you know, if there's some stats, you know, to show that there's some evidence that, you know, this is more than just a faith thing, you know. So that helps. Why don't I just stop there? I think you get the idea. For me, it's migrating those millennial teachings into a language that people understand and can appreciate. And, of course, the big one is Krishna. That's how to get people to understand Krishna. That it has absolutely nothing to do with philosophy, I can tell you that. The hesitation, the resistance that I experience, because I start off every one of my classes, I don't care where it is and whether I've met these people before, we start up with a round of japa, some kirtan. I tell them the basics. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is a Bhagavad Gita, his teachings, read it. And we end with artik and prasadam. You know, it's like wherever I go, that's what we do. Then I'll also try and bring this other stuff in, you know, because then it's like, well, that was convincing. I guess I got to go with the other things too, you know. But when it comes to Krishna, the resistance really has very, very little to do with philosophy. You can talk about nirguna and saguna and mayavada and this and that till you're blue in the face, and people will still resist the idea that God is a person. Why? Why would people resist the idea that God is a person?
All the persons they know are defective.
Defective, sure. I mean, you know, when have you found anybody who's everything? You know. Yes. Yes. If God's an idea or an energy, fine. It's, you know, no sweat off my brow. I don't have to worry about anyone controlling my free will or telling me what to do or what not to do. So why this preference for Buddhism? You know, because Buddhism, basically, there's no obligation. There's no regulative principle. You don't have to do anything. You know, it's just like very nice, you know, very austere, you know, very this beautiful kind of simplicity to it. And also, you know, the kind of Tibetan people cause, you know. As long as it doesn't require anything of you. Yes?
They complain that Krishna is a foreign god.
Right. If Krishna, then not Jesus. All right. That's another big objection, right? Or not, you know, Yahweh, or not, you know, some other name for God. Sure, that's another objection that people have. What are some other reasons why people might have a hard time with Krishna as a person.
Someone's false ego may become so overinflated that they simply cannot afford to conceive that anybody is above me. Everyone has to be below me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that idea that anyone has control over my life, that there's an individual, a person, who gets to decide my fate, you know, that's objectionable on all kinds of grounds. Another one that often comes up is that it's not particularly scientific. You know, that's a concern that people will express, that, well, you know, there's no way to prove it. So, you know, it's not grounded in the science. Again, we want to see those stats. I'll tell you what the core reason is that I've found, is that being a person is really painful. Every relationship that we've had, if you think about it, has been fraught with pain. There probably has not been a relationship in your life or mine that hasn't been difficult, challenging, painful. You know, I've given my heart so many times, and every time it's been broken. You know? Why would I want to do that again? You know, why are you imposing yet again this idea of a person that's just going to break my heart? Of course, actually, he does break your heart, but it's in a different way. So we don't want to believe that God is a person, because our experience of being a person is very sad, you know. Everyone else I've tried to love, you know, they've always broken my heart. So Krishna goes out of his way, of course, you know, I'm not like those other boys. Yeah.
Which is powerful, is prayer or karma?
Which is what?
Powerful. Prayer or karma is powerful?
Which is more powerful, prayer or karma? Oh my goodness, what an interesting question. Well, the effects of karma can be very old, but they're not permanent. Karma can be overcome by a number of things. Prayer is one way. If you're using prayer in the sense of regret that you've done harm, so my dear Lord, kindly help me to rectify the wrongs that I've done. That's one way of reversing karma. Some karma has not yet fructified. You know, the different stages of karma. There's full-blown karma. There's karma that's just beginning to sprout. There's karma that's still not manifest. That kind of karma can be stopped. You don't have to experience karmic reaction if you make apologies. The South African courts at the end of the apartheid era, the CRTs, the courts of CTRs, Courts of Truth and Reconciliation, were predicated on this idea that if you step forward and admit your wrongdoing and offer to make amends somehow, and if the people whom you have harmed agree to accept your apology, you can avoid jail time. Now, that formula does not migrate. You couldn't have done that on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. I mean, there are places where it just won't work. But in South Africa, it was predicated on that idea that prayer or regret, you know, sincerely lamenting our behavior and changing that behavior can overcome karmic reaction. So prayer, in that sense, would be more powerful. Yeah?
What if it was your karma to be in a crippled body, for instance, due to your past activity, and mm-hmm. you're in a crippled body, and even though you feel bad for what you've done and you pray, I mean, you're still going to be in a crippled body. So how does that work, prayer?
How does prayer work in that case, in a situation where no amount of prayer is going to necessarily reverse your condition? Is that your point?
I was just wondering. Yeah. You were saying prayer can do that.
Well, there's an example of karma where the effects cannot be avoided, but they can be minimized. You can stop incurring further karma so that the effects from past hurtful activity that you are now experiencing the consequences of, once that has been done, it will not occur again. So there are some situations that we just can't reverse. I mean, you know, my son and I and my daughter-in-law are facing that every day. You know, their daughter has cerebral palsy and audio neuropathy and all kinds of, you know, things. And no amount of prayer on our part is going to change that. We can try to make her life less painful, but she will die at some point without ever having seen, more than likely, any real change in her condition. So what do you do with that? You know, so it's kind of like, you know, 10th chapter, 11th chapter Bhagavad Gita. You know, you look at the universal form and what do you do? The universal form is every reason for becoming an atheist. You know, you can look at the injustice in the world, the hurt, the pain, the suffering, the frustration of evil people winning. You know, what is that? And you can be frustrated by it and just give up faith. Or you can go deeper. The downside of walking away from a tricky situation is that you'll never understand it. You'll have to live with that bitterness. So better to go inside it, even though that's more, it appears to be more difficult. You go deeper inside that experience. That's really what Krishna consciousness is, all right, in a nutshell. All right, now we're having the kind of class I would have up at Jiva Mukti in New York, okay? You want to talk about things that, you know, you're having to deal with and they're not going to change. So where is Krishna in that? Where is Krishna in that? Well, it's for darn sure you're not going to see him staying on that surface level of understanding of your condition. And unless you can bring that bitterness down far enough to have a serious conversation about this, nothing that I say or that the Bhagavad Gita says is going to change your point of view. So your choice is, how do you respond to that? You've heard this kind of a cliche now, but pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. The pain may be inevitable, but how you respond to that, that's up to you. Let me give you an example. A soldier shot on the battlefield is lying there and thinking, you know what? I'm not dead. Okay, that's good. And they're going to have to send me home because I'm wounded. I can't fight anymore. That's good. And maybe they'll put me in a VA hospital. I'll meet some pretty young nurse. That's good. And when I get back home, they're going to call me a hero and give me a parade and some medals. So when the paramedics show up with morphine, they say, hey, guy, you need some morphine? The guy will say, give it to somebody who needs it more than I do. Because the internal story is strong. Same situation in a bodega somewhere. Someone's been shot in a holdup, and he's lying there on the ground thinking, you know, my insurance isn't going to cover this. I can't afford anybody to run the shop while I'm home recovering. I'm going to lose my business. I'm not going to be able to feed my family. So when the paramedics show up, hey, guy, would you like some morphine? Doc, give me all you got. I'm suffering. Now, what's the difference there? The difference is that internal story. Krishna consciousness is the original story. Krishna consciousness is that original foundational core self, which can never be hurt, which is never impeded, no matter what kind of physical impediments there may be. Spiritually, you are whole. You are unblemished. All of this other stuff is dealing with the facade. It's dealing with the externals. So to be open to that requires a little, you know, chanting, a little practice. So that's the kind of way we would deal with that kind of a question up at Jiva Mukti. Yeah.
Isn't it really, reawakening the soul or recognizing the soul, heart, and mind and the things that we have done? Because we all know the things that when we're doing something, on the actions we do, whether it's mischievous or whether it's thought processing in different ways, that it's like reawakening again. So that the karma that we've done in the past, as it's coming through...
I'm getting lost in this a little bit. Can you summarize your question for me a little more?
Well, when you were talking about karma, and as far as like when somebody's suffering, if they have like cerebral palsy or something like that, and a lot of these people though, that instead of like the, some people go, woe is me, and then there's other people that do other great things. And it seems like those people that do great things, even though that they have these conditions, that they have a like their soul has been recognized again with their mind or the acceptance of. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. Let me see. I'll feed it back to you, and you tell me if I've understood.
Okay.
You're saying, what makes the difference between somebody who's dealing with a really difficult situation and who's defeated by that situation, and somebody else who's facing the same situation but somehow manages to overcome or to move forward with it? Am I getting your question?
Okay.
Is that more or less where we are?
Well, I was looking at it from like where it's a recognition of the soul and mind, where the mind has been taught just to feel, where the soul is no longer feeling anymore from where we're at. And then when you have that awakening, we'll say, or the feeling of guilt or whatever that's going on, the soul arises and then you come above.
I'm still not sure I'm following you completely, but let me see if I can give you something back, because you're entitled to an answer. There are moments that occur, and for each of us it comes in our own way and in our own time, and there is no general cliche about how it's going to happen or when it's going to happen or why. A moment comes in our life when you have what can be called an awakening, an epiphany, an aha moment, where something you might have even heard many, many times before finally breaks through. And it makes all the difference in the world. There was there's a book by a woman named Evelyn Underhill, written in 1904, simply called Mysticism. And she tracks the mystic experience. And in there she talks about a French priest from the 16th century named Brother Lawrence. Brother Lawrence had been a soldier, and then coming out of the army went into a monastery in Paris. And he became the cook for the monastery. And he... one of his famous sayings was that when I'm in the kitchen and doing so many things and there's so much noise and clutter and people are asking for so many things, he says, I'm in the same kind of blissful experience as I am when I'm in the sanctuary praying. Because he began to understand that God is everywhere and the kitchen is also a sanctuary, right? One morning after about 20 years of living this life of understanding that God is everywhere, he walks out of the monastery and sees a tree and faints. He sees a tree, something that we see every single day. But it finally hit him. It finally broke through. The miracle of that tree finally got to him. And he swooned, and he came to 5 or 6 hours later. The ecstasy, the perfection of that moment, something that he'd seen every single day, just finally broke through. We could talk about this one thing. I mean, the idea of an epiphany or a breakthrough moment is classic. I mean, it's, you know, Joseph Campbell calls it the belly of the whale, you know, in the hero myth. It's that moment when life is going to change one way or another. And either you embrace that moment and you come alive, you're reborn, or you sink. You die, basically, because there's no going back to your old life. When that moment happens, when you realize, oh my Krishna, you're real. You're real. And when that happens, there's no going back. And what you do with that, that's your choice. That's your choice. So maybe that's coming close to what you're asking about. Okay. I asked Prabhupada one time. Mukhya is pressuring me into giving Prabhupada stories, right? I asked Prabhupada one time in Paris, I guess it was. I said, what's it like being a pure devotee? I was a little brazen, you know. I used to ask him all kinds of things. I never held back. And he was always very patient and very kind. He always answered me, too. He didn't take any offense at all. And I said, so what's it like being a pure devotee for you, just walking down the street? I mean, what do you see? How, when you see something, when you see a tree, I asked him, when you see a tree, how is that different from when I look at a tree? How does a pure devotee see a tree? And he says, well, you look at a tree and you understand it's not just the tree body, but that inside there's an eternal soul. And that soul, you don't just see the soul. A pure devotee sees a tree, knows that in that tree there's a spark of Krishna, and therefore he sees Krishna there. So you're not just seeing a tree, you're not just seeing the soul that animates that tree, you're seeing Krishna. That was a beautiful, beautiful answer. I mean, in that sense, everything around us is an impetus to ecstatic love of God, if you see it in the right way. Everything, every single common, ordinary, everyday event of your life can trigger utter ecstatic love for Radha Shyam Sundar. You just have to recognize that Krishna is there in that moment. Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam govindamadi purusham tamaham vidhis. There in the atoms, in between the atoms, everything. Krishna is present everywhere. That's pretty great. The same circumstance. Someone who is not trained in Krishna consciousness and someone who is trained in Krishna consciousness, the same, that circumstance for this person defeats them. They're in that pit of despair that you were talking about. You know, I'm in a situation, I can't do nothing. I am helpless here. The same circumstance for someone trained in Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna. That was the verse that Krishna Chetra read early this morning from the 10th canto. Tatenu kampasu samikshamano bunjana ivatmakritam vipakam sadayabak. You see your life like that, and devotional service is your inheritance. You're not defeated, you're enlivened. Wow, what a life. Pretty spectacular. Any other questions, comments, criticisms, anything at all? Yeah.
I just wanted to say thank you. This has been a really inspiring class.
Oh gosh, aren't you nice? That'll keep me going for another few weeks. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Thank you all very much.